wonderful listeners, and welcome to the hashtag SDR Ask podcast with Amy Hall and Greg Kokol.
That's a new one. Hello, wonderful Amy.
Hello, Greg.
Well, hello, Greg. Oh.
That's all you're getting from
no
me.
Accolade, no accolade, no superlatives there, huh? All right, down to work.
Maybe I'll
then.
Compliment you later after you work for it.
All right. Oh.
All right, so let's start with the first question. This one comes from Steph. A pro-choice person recently made me aware that a great number of human embryos created for IVF are thrown away from fertility clinics. I don't agree with their overall point, but as pro-life people, is this something we should also be concerned about? Now, Steph doesn't say what their overall point was, so I'm not sure what that was. It could be that they are saying, well, look, we just throw these away, so obviously they're not valuable. It could be, look, you don't care about this, so obviously they're not, you know, you don't really care about them or whatever. But regardless of what that point was, is this something we should be concerned about?
Yeah, in principle. Simply put, yes. Our argument is that it's wrong to take the life of innocent human beings, and abortion takes the life of an innocent human being. Therefore, abortion is wrong. Now, of course, abortion can happen at many stages of the pregnancy, and it is scientifically clear that the unborn is a human being from the moment that individual comes into existence, even though at that moment that human being is microscopically small. It just keeps growing. By the way, it doesn't just keep growing in the womb. It keeps growing after it gets out of the womb. It doesn't look like a human being. Sure, it does. It looks like exactly like all human beings do at that stage of development. Every stage of development, human beings look different. That's what it means to grow and be a living thing. Just think of insects who have an egg stage, larval stage, a pupa stage, and an adult stage. Those are all radically different, you know, but still the same individual going through those different stages. So so all of these embryos that are created by IVF are individual, valuable human beings that should be given a chance at life. And in the case of the secular use of them, whatever's not needed is thrown out. That is a destruction of actual human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know when I say that, some people might be tempted to kind of raise their eyebrows a little bit, even some who are tend to be pro-life with regards to especially later stages in the pregnancy. But the way we have, at Standard Reason, developed this argument is around a simple question. What is it? That's the question. Whether it's right or wrong to kill any living thing depends on the answer to the question, what is it? Abortion and IVF, et cetera, like what was just described, kills something. Whether it's right or wrong to kill that thing depends on what it is. And if those things don't kill a valuable human being, then no justification for abortion is necessary. Just have it. You don't have to talk about privacy and choice and all those things. You don't need all that. But if it is a valuable human being, then none of those justifications are adequate because we don't take the life of innocent human beings for the reasons that people characteristically give for abortion. The case here with the embryos, they're just, we're done. We don't need them, and we toss them. Okay. Now, physically, it's easy to do that, and it doesn't hurt us emotionally most to do that, just like somebody who pushes the button on the bomb bay doors, flying, a bomber over Dresden. He's dropping all these napalm firebombs. He didn't see all the people that get wiped out in that destructive fire that happens. So emotionally, it's not difficult. But the fact of the matter is those are valuable human beings that are perishing. And the same fact is here, even though we are not as emotionally connected to it. So, so that's on the one thing, just on the moral element here. Now there's a more of a policy concern about how we address these things. Do those fall under the broad category of innocent human beings whose lives are being lost for frivolous reasons? The answer is yes. Now you have a judicial question of how do you stop the whole thing? You got to start somewhere. And if you want slavery to end in the world, which I'm sure William Wilberforce wanted to have happen, you can't try to fight the whole world. You fight in your own country to end it in your own country as a way of starting that process, which he did. And soon after, slavery came to an end in the Americas as well, or at least North America and the United States. And so this is a process. And sometimes people will say, well, if you care about these unborn babies, then why don't you care about these embryos that are being tossed out? Well, caring about them can be taken two ways. Why don't you care enough to do something about it, or why don't you feel as badly about it? Well, you're not going to feel badly about thousands and thousands of human beings dying that you have no visibility of. You don't feel bad. That's why people have abortions. It's not so hard for them emotionally because they don't see it. When they see a video of it, that's a whole different story. So that's one reason why we may not be as passionate about it as we are about the other, but also you have to divide your efforts. You have to decide where you're going to put your efforts to best effect. And even though we might care in principle about it, we can't care by giving time to it because we're trying to fight a different battle right now that's more pressing on the broader issue. Just like Wilberforce started where he did, we start where we do. And
but we do spend time on it. There's plenty of things on our website, actually, about
this
very topic. There are so many frozen embryos out there that have just been abandoned, or parents are giving them away to research. I mean, it's pretty atrocious. Mm-hmm. And you also have done something about it by adopting some. Mm-hmm.
Well, not only have we adopted our daughters, but we also adopted embryos before
right.
we had our daughters,
that's what you're referring to.
And there's organizations like Snowflake, mm-hmm. which that term has a different meaning nowadays in popular culture, unfortunately. But it's a way where people understand that these embryos are human beings. They attempt to do their best to find a home for them, give them a chance to live by giving them to couples who have difficulty reproducing.
So if you're looking for something about this on our website, there's a post titled The Tragic Consequences of the IVF Industry. And there's also a podcast that Alan and I did called What You Might Not Know About IVF. Mm-hmm. And so this is the pro-life movement does talk about this. But when I think everyone has focused their legal battles on abortion for now.
Yeah. And I think that's a judicious use of our energies. I mean, we do give, as you mentioned, attention to this other issue, mm-hmm. because it is in the broader category. It is wrong for the same reasons. But my concern is when people get assaulted by pro-choicers and they say, well, you care about this baby, but you don't care about these others. And on your view, they're just as valuable. That's why people bring up the illustration about if you have a IVF clinic burning down, would you save the human being? Would you save a bottle? The person in there or a bunch of the frozen embryos, you know, they kind of put this at you. But they're trying to do the same thing. They're trying to fault you based on some of these actions because you seem not to be consistent. And part of my response to that is, look, you can't do everything. You can't do everything. You can't save every single person. You got to do what you can do.
It does worry me, though, that she's never heard that they were throwing away these embryos. Because I feel like, I mean, I've written about this many times, and mm-hmm. we talk about it. You've talked about it. And it does worry me that there are, you know, even somebody who follows us doesn't even know that this is going on. Mm-hmm. It's a big problem.
Well, I'm glad she asked about it then.
Yeah, me too.
Because now she did find out, and now we're able to talk a little bit about it. Now she's informed, and so many other people are as well.
All right, so let's go on to a question from LMB. I've heard the annihilation and universalism views of eternity. Recently, I've heard the view that in eternity, those not in heaven will still have chance for redemption. Supporters say God's mercies never cease, and the word, quote, eternity is misinterpreted. What's an appropriate response?
Well, regardless of how one translates the word eternity, or let me back up and put it this way, the answer to this question doesn't hinge on how long eternity is. It hinges on the question of whether there is a second chance after death, okay? And this is I'm just dealing with frustration right now because the way people have tried to proof text a faulty view. They find some verse that they can make application with regarding their own idea, which verse wasn't specifically meant to address that, but can be stretched to cover it or appear to cover their issue, while they ignore the very straightforward teaching in other texts that speak explicitly to the question. Now, Tim Barnett and I just finished up a series, three different solid grounds, the title which is Hell Interrupted, to deal with this broader question. Yes, his mercies are forever for those who get his mercies. It doesn't mean that no matter where anybody is, whether they're the devil in hell, all they have to do is ask for God's mercy and there it's given to them. All right? That isn't what it means. And with regards to the devil in hell and others who receive that sentence, the scripture is very clear. Jesus in Matthew 25, I believe, the separation of the sheep and the goats, and just parallels what John says in Revelation 20. Did I say Matthew? Matthew 25 in Revelation 20, where you have a very clear picture of the final judgment, which Jesus presides over. He is the final judge. And all whose names were not written in the book of life were cast in the lake of fire, which the text describes as tormenting the beast and the prophet and the devil forever and ever. And it seems quite clear in the text that those who get the same, thrown in the same place, experience the same sentence. Hebrews says, it is appointed to man once to die, and then comes the judgment. Why was the gospel to go out aggressively to all nations when it didn't matter that much because after people die, they still get another shot at it, you know? No, there was an immediacy to this because death marked the final determinant of what your ultimate destiny would be. Once you pass through that door permanently, that's it. There's no other chances. This is where LDS make huge mistakes because of their understanding of the phrase in 1 Corinthians 15 about baptism for the dead. These kinds of doctrines, whether it's baptism for the dead by the LDS or this application of the verse about the mercy of God, flies directly in the face of very well-established, clearly articulated, detailed information by inspired biblical authors about these issues. Mm-hmm. And it just strikes me as so specious when somebody wants to dig into a text and find a little phrase that they can use as a proof text for a doctrine that is clearly contrary to biblical teaching.
So here's a related question from Brendan Coburn. What do you think of C.S. Lewis's view of hell? He is quoted as saying, all that are in hell choose it, and the door is locked from the inside. I'm finding this hard to reconcile with Scripture. Is hell a choice or a punishment or both?
Well, yeah, this is where Lewis, it's not clear to me how we're entirely to understand what he says there. He also has some writings about heaven, The Great Divorce, for example, is a book that plays on these notions. And I think sometimes these things are fanciful. In other words, he's using literary genres to kind of paint with broad strokes about things, but not meant to really be particularly doctrinaire about these things, precisely theologically correct. There is a sense in which it's locked from the inside. One could say, even though people are sent there, I mean, Jesus says, depart from me, you who work iniquity. I never knew you. And this is the climax of the judgment there in Matthew 25. And then we see they are thrown into the lake of fire. This is in Revelation 20. So, or they are cast away from the presence of the Lord forever, 1 Thessalonians chapter 1. So you have these characterizations of the last judgment that make it very clear that Jesus the judge, God on the throne, is the one responsible for the sentence that's being received. But why is the sentence being received in that way? Just think of a criminal in culture. A criminal chooses to commit crimes for which the judge passes sentence on. It's the judge that passes sentence, but it's the criminal who made the choices that led to that. So in a certain sense, they choose the consequence. No, they didn't choose to be tormented forever. I mean, they're not thinking, hey, that sounds like a good time. I'll try that for a while. No, but they are choosing the things that have this consequence. And so the choice, in a certain sense, is theirs. And that the door is locked on the inside, you have made a comment before about people continuing to rebel against God even in hell, so they continue to be guilty, and therefore eternal punishment is justified in that. I'm not sure if I agree with that, but it might be that this is what Lewis has in mind, that it's locked on the inside, because what's required is for them to bend the knee and properly honor God, and this is something they don't want to do, so they would rather have this than that. So that might be the point he's making, but even if that's the point he's making, I think it just strikes me as a little hyperbolic. He's kind of making an exaggerated way of putting it to kind of make a point. But that's the best I could do with Lewis's comment.
Yeah, just to add on to what you said about what they're choosing, besides just choosing to do the things that they're not supposed to do, they are also choosing not to be with God. Like, they don't want to be with God. So I think in that sense, it's a choice. But I agree with you that I don't think I would. I'm not exactly sure what he's saying, and right. I'm not sure that I would agree with that.
Thomas Nagel, famous philosopher, New York University, still alive and making his contribution, has stated quite bluntly, he does not want there to be a God. Christopher Hitchens said the same thing. And many of these vocal atheists have made this very clear. I don't want to bend my knee. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want somebody to tell me how to live my life or who I can sleep with. And that, by the way, is a huge deal with a lot of these guys. They do not want their sensuality, their sensual liberties to be infringed in any way. And so some people are actually quite candid about this particular point. I don't want God. I want my way, not his way.
Okay, let's do one more question.
All right.
This one comes from Alice. Meeting / hearing about people who are Wiccan seems to be getting more common. I looked up some videos on YouTube about it, but are there any resources you would recommend for how to talk to Wiccans about spiritual things?
Well, I don't know about resources. I know that a friend I haven't seen in a long time but used to broadcast with, Craig Hawkins, wrote a book on witchcraft, but this was quite a number of years ago. And I don't know that witchcraft has changed much, so it still could be a good book, excuse me, if it's still in print. But I don't traffic in that stuff personally very much. But I will say this. And again, I feel funny because it's like I'm always kind of beating the same drum here. But the best place to find out about witchcraft and Wicca is from a witch asking her two questions.
Let me guess.
What do you mean by that? And how'd you come to that conclusion?
Right.
Or some variation. Just draw that person out. You don't make any commitment at the front end to witnessing to her. I know this is a little controversial thing to say, but here's the reason I'm saying it, because if you think you're going to go, get into spiritual things, you're going to have to get to the gospel. Many of you will not open that door because it's too scary for you. You don't think you're up to it. So just commit yourself to gathering information. I just, I'm just in from Paraguay here. I haven't been home yet. I just got off the plane and drove in. last night in Sao Paulo in a restaurant in the airport. I sat with a young LDS man. Met him. We started talking. And I was tired. I didn't think, oh, I want to get in to talk about religion. And I thought, well, all I have to do is ask him some questions about his views. And that's what I did. And then once you're kind of in a rhythm of just drawing another person out in a very friendly way, which I think most people are flattered by, then it becomes easier to move a little closer and see what the Lord will do. And so I don't think we should be afraid of people who are in Wicca. Just ask them about their own views and then see what happens. Don't commit yourself to getting into a big spiritual discussion. Just first step, gather information. And then, you know, that would be a learning experience right there.
Yeah, that's what I love about tactics, because you can talk to anyone about their views. You can talk to anyone about the gospel using those tactics, because you are getting a personalized view of who they are and what they believe just by asking the questions. So hopefully that will help you out there, Alice, and everyone listening. Thank you all for sending in your questions. Please keep sending those in on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.